approver's whim. The lack of computer support, however, was a failure of the Bureau's leadership. In New York, I saw piles of terrorism files on the floor of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. There was only one low-paid file clerk there, and he could not keep up with the volume of paper that was being generated. Wiretap recordings lay around for weeks because there were too few Arabic or Farsi or Pushto speakers. When the FBI did uncover something interesting and report it to Washington, no written record of it ever left the Bureau. The volume of the reporting from other agencies became so great that we established a threat subgroup that tracked leads on an Excel spreadsheet called the Threat Matrix. The subgroup went through the reports asking, what was the source of the information? Was the source ever right before? Is there any independent way to verify the report? What should we do to deal with the possible threat? The subgroup then followed up, going back to the report, until it could be negated or struck from the list of active threats. One day, I specifically remember, mild-mannered Roger Cressy marched into my office after a threat subgroup meeting and announced, "That fucker is going to get some Americans killed. He just sits there like a bump on a log. Nothing to report, no comment on anyone else's work, doesn't want to check on anything." I knew he was talking about an FBI representative. When we would ask the FBI if there were criminal violations of support to terrorism, such as establishing websites, soliciting funds, or other means of terrorist financing, we would get blank stares. The two bright lights in the FBI were John O'Neill and Dale Watson, who replaced O'Neill in Washington when John went to the New York office. They were a study in contrasts. O'Neill could have passed for a Boston Irish congressman who read GQ magazine. Watson pretended to be a good old boy and actually chewed tobacco. Watson had come to the FBI headquarters job, having spent 2 years in the CIA Counterterrorism Center. He knew his stuff. When Dale Watson sat down with me to develop the Millennium After Action Review, he knew he had a problem. "We have to smash the FBI into bits and rebuild it to do terrorism," Dale confided. "We're off running around after crooks who rob banks when there are people planning to kill Americans, right here in the USA." Hallelujah, I thought. Watson got free to approve a meeting in Tampa for all senior FBI supervisors from all 56 offices. He asked me to begin the meeting by telling the audience what Al-Qaeda was and what they wanted to do. I began, "Al-Qaeda is a worldwide political conspiracy, masquerading as a religious sect. It engages in murder of innocent people to grab attention. Its goal is a 14th century style theocracy in which women have no rights, everyone is forced to be a Muslim, and the Sharia legal system is used to cut off hands and stone people to death. They are our number one enemy, and they are amongst us, in your cities. Find them." Watson followed me. "They are the FBI's number one priority in terrorism. You will find them." "One more thing," Watson added. "Your bonus, your promotion, your city of assignment all depend upon how well you do this mission. If you don't believe me, try me." Dale was not being a good old boy anymore. As Watson walked me to the car, he said, "The FBI is like an aircraft carrier. It takes a long time to stop going in one direction and turn around and go in another." He was starting, but it would take years of consistent top-down management to fix. We had been throwing millions of dollars at the FBI for counterterrorism, and they did not even have any data system that allowed the Joint Terrorism Task Forces to share information. The Millennium After Action Review established 29 recommendations, most aimed at the threat of foreign terrorists in the United States. The aircraft carrier was turning into the wind of foreign terrorists in the United States. It had taken too long. The president also received a summary of the after-action review, along with an update on the CIA's attempts to get bin Laden, or at least to tell us where to fire cruise missiles. Clinton was not pleased with the CIA's progress. I thought we needed new eyes looking at the problem of locating the Al-Qaeda leadership long enough to permit us to act. Charlie Allen was managing intelligence collection priorities for the entire intelligence community. I asked him to meet with the three-star admiral who was the director of operations for the Joint Staff, Scott Fry. The two came back with a novel idea. Instead of depending on unreliable human assets to find bin Laden, why not fly an unmanned aircraft around? The new Predator had a long dwell time, and it provided a real-time video feed, even if it was 10,000 miles away. There were a few problems. First, we would need to get some Predators, and they were in short supply. Some were being used in Bosnia, and some in Iraq. Second, we would need to find some money to pay for the operation. Finally, we would need to get the agencies to agree to do it. It was the last problem that proved to be the biggest hurdle. Too risky, too costly, too not invented here. In this case, Sandy Berger virtually instructed that the mission be carried out. By September, the satellite links and other necessary little technical issues were worked out, and the first Predator flew into Afghanistan. Roger Cressy and I made midnight trips to watch Kandahar on a giant video screen in Northern Virginia. The bird flew quietly over a known terrorist camp, and, as it did, a Land Rover was headed toward the gate. "Follow that car," the mission controller called out to the pilot seated in front of him in the darkened Virginia room. He then turned to me and Cressy and with a big grin said, "I always wanted to say that." The pilot kept the Land Rover on screen as it moved through market squares and in and out of a tunnel. Finally, it pulled up in front of a villa, and those in the vehicle went inside. "Well, we now know that villa is Al-Qaeda related." Predators flew in September and October of 2000. One Predator was damaged during takeoff, setting off a bureaucratic fight over who would pay the few $100,000 to repair it. On another flight, the Taliban's radar detected the Predator, and an ancient MiG fighter was launched. The Predator's camera watched as the fighter plane lumbered into the air, climbed, and began a big circle that ended with the fighter about 2 miles from the Predator, aimed right at it. The image of the MiG grew from a speck to an enormous object hurtling at the camera. "Holy shit, it's going to hit us," the controller yelled, as half the people in the control room dove under their desks. 10,000 miles away, the MiG flew right by the Predator, apparently unable to see it. From the camera images on three flights, I'm convinced that I was looking at bin Laden. There were no submarines off the coast to fire. The Navy had been trying for months to get its submarines back and had succeeded. The seasonal winds were also picking up, making it impossible for the Predator to fly over the mountains it had to traverse. Reluctantly, we agreed that the flights would resume when the winter was over. The Air Force had been intending to experiment with placing small rockets or missiles on the Predator, with a view to possibly having a working capability in 2004. We asked them to have it ready for the late spring of 2001. Much has been written about the origins of the Predator unmanned aerial vehicle, and about the bureaucratic battles that followed my proposal to use it as a counter-terrorist weapon in the fight against Al-Qaeda. In their book, The Age of Sacred Terror, Dan Benjamin and Steve Simon quote a senior DOD official as saying that the CIA opposed the initial use of Predator, and the White House, quote, had to cram this down the throat of the agency, unquote. On the issue of flying an armed version of the Predator to attack Al-Qaeda, Benjamin and Simon add that, quote, the head of the Directorate of Operations, Jim Pavitt, was heard to say that if the Predator was used against bin Laden, and the responsibility for this use of lethal force was laid at the agency's doorstep, it would endanger the lives of CIA operatives around the world, end quote. Finally, they note that in a White House meeting a week before September 11th, CIA Director George Tenet, quote, intervened forcefully. It would be a terrible mistake, he declared, for the Director of Central Intelligence to fire a weapon like this, unquote. The New Yorker quotes Roger Cressy as saying of the bureaucratic dispute about the use of armed predator prior to September 11th, quote, "It sounds terrible, but we used to say to each other that some people didn't get it. It was going to take body bags," unquote. It did. The armed predator flew after Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, only following September 11th. It proved highly successful. During the Predator's trial run in October 2000, an Al-Qaeda cell that had sunk its own explosive-laden boat around the time of the millennium tried once again to attack a U.S. destroyer in Aden, Yemen. This time they succeeded and killed 17 American sailors aboard the USS Cole. For over 3 years, the Counterterrorism Security Group had been concerned with security at the ports in the region that were being used by the U.S. Navy. When the USS Cole was attacked, we were shocked to learn that the Navy was even making port calls in Yemen. Mike Sheehan, then the State Department's representative on the Counterterrorism Security Group, had summed up our feelings. "Yemen's a viper's nest of terrorists. What the fuck was Cole doing there in the first place?" As in the case of Khobar and the East Africa embassy bombings, the FBI sent out a large team to collect evidence and interrogate witnesses. Ever the hands-on guy, John O'Neill led the team. He ran right into the U.S. ambassador I would least like to deal with under those circumstances, Barbara Bodine. O'Neill could charm a corpse, but he could not find a modus vivendi with the U.S. ambassador to Yemen. The Yemeni government also dragged its feet in the investigation, leading to President Clinton's becoming personally involved. The U.S. government left the Yemenis in no doubt about the two alternative paths that Yemeni-American relations could take. Meanwhile, in Washington, in principals' discussions, it was difficult to gain support for a retaliatory strike when neither the FBI nor the CIA would say that Al-Qaeda had done it. Once again, I proposed bombing all of the Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan without tying the operation to getting bin Laden or even to retaliating for the Cole. There was no support for bombing. On a brisk October day in 2000, Mike Sheehan, the State Department's leading counterterrorism official, stood with me on West Executive Avenue and watched as the limousines left the White House meeting on the Cole attack to go back to the Pentagon. "What's it gonna take, Dick?" Sheehan demanded. "Who the shit do they think attacked the Cole? Fucking Martians? The Pentagon brass won't let Delta go get bin Laden. Hell, they won't even let the Air Force carpet bomb the place. Does Al-Qaeda have to attack the Pentagon to get their attention?" Time was running out on the Clinton administration. There was going to be one last major national security initiative, and it was going to be a final try to achieve an Israeli-Palestinian agreement. There would be another chance to go after the camps. The principals asked me to update the Paul Mill plan for the transition, flagging the issues where there was not consensus, where decisions had not been agreed. I listed aiding the Northern Alliance, eliminating the camps, and flying armed predators to eliminate the Al-Qaeda leadership. Clinton left office with bin Laden alive, but having authorized actions to eliminate him and to step up the attacks on Al-Qaeda. He had defeated Al-Qaeda when it had attempted to take over Bosnia by having its fighters dominate the defenses of the breakaway state from Serbian attacks. He had seen earlier than anyone that terrorism would be the major new threat facing America, and therefore had greatly increased funding for counterterrorism and had initiated homeland protection programs. He had put an end to Iraqi and Iranian terrorism against the United States by quickly acting against the intelligence services of each nation. In the absence of a bigger provocation from Al-Qaeda to silence his critics, Clinton thought he could do no more. Nonetheless, he put in place the plans and programs that allowed America to respond to the big attacks when they did come, sweeping away the political barriers to action. When Clinton left office, many people, including the incoming Bush administration leadership, thought that he and his administration were overly obsessed with Al-Qaeda. After all, Al-Qaeda had killed only a few Americans, nothing like the hundreds of Marines who died at the hands of the Beirut terrorists during the Reagan administration, or the hundreds of Americans who were killed by Libya on Pan Am 103 during the first Bush administration. Those two acts had not provoked U.S. military retaliation. Why was Clinton so worked up about al-Qaeda? And why did he talk to President-elect Bush about it and have Sandy Berger raise it with his successor as National Security Advisor, Condi Rice? In January 2001, the new administration, from their perspective, really thought Clinton's recommendations that eliminating al-Qaeda be one of their highest priorities, well, rather odd, like so many of the Clinton administration's actions. Chapter 10. Before and after September 11th. Al-Qaeda planned attacks years in advance, inserted sleeper cells, did reconnaissance. They took the long view, believing that their struggle would take decades, perhaps generations. America worked on a 4-year electoral cycle, and at the end of 2000, a new cycle was beginning. In the presidential campaign, terrorism had not been discussed. George Bush and Dick Cheney had mentioned the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia. They had also talked about Iraq. In January 2001, with the Florida electoral fiasco behind us, I briefed each of my old friends and associates from the first Bush administration: Condi Rice, Steve Hadley, Dick Cheney, and Colin Powell. My message was stark. Al-Qaeda is at war with us. It is a highly capable organization, probably with sleeper cells in the U.S., and it is clearly planning a major series of attacks against us. We must act decisively and quickly, deciding on the issues prepared after the attack on the coal, going on the offensive. Each person reacted differently. Cheney was, as ever, quiet and calm on the surface. The wheels were spinning behind the mask. He asked an aide to arrange for a visit to CIA to learn their view of the al-Qaeda threat. That was fine by me, because I knew that George Tenet would be even more alarmist than I had been about what al-Qaeda was planning. Cheney did make the trip up the parkway to CIA headquarters, one of many he would make. Most of the visits focused on Iraq and left mid-level managers and analysts wondering whether the seasoned vice president was right about the Iraqi threat. Perhaps they should adjust their own analysis. In the first weeks of the administration, however, Cheney had heard me loud and clear about al-Qaeda. Now that he was attending the National Security Council principals meetings, chaired by Condi Rice, something no vice president had ever done, I hoped he would speak up about the urgency of the problem, put it on the short list for immediate action. He didn't. Colin Powell took the unusual step during the transition of asking to meet with the Counterterrorism Security Group. When we all agreed on the importance of the al-Qaeda threat, Powell was obviously surprised at the unanimity. Brian Sheridan, the soon-departing Assistant Secretary of Defense, summed it up. "General Powell, I'll be leaving when the administration changes. I'm the only political appointee in the room. All these guys are career professionals. So let me give you one piece of advice, untainted by any personal interest. Keep this interagency team together and make al-Qaeda your number one priority." I met Condi Rice wandering the halls of the executive office building, looking for my office. I escorted her there and gave her the same briefing on al-Qaeda that I had been using with the others. Condi Rice's reaction was very polite, as she almost always is. She was the fourth national security advisor I had worked for, and the seventh I had worked with. As I briefed Rice on al-Qaeda, her facial expression gave me the impression that she had never heard the term before. So I added, "Most people think of it as Osama bin Laden's group, but it's much more than that. It's a network of affiliated terrorist organizations with cells in over 50 countries, including the U.S. Rice looked skeptical. She focused on the fact that my office staff was large by national security standards, 12 people, and did operational things, including domestic security. She said, I'm not sure we will want to keep all of this in the NSC. Rice viewed the National Security Council as a foreign policy coordination mechanism, and not someplace where issues such as terrorism in the U.S. or domestic preparedness for weapons of mass destruction or computer network security should be addressed. I realized that Rice and her deputy Steve Hadley were still operating with the old Cold War paradigm from when they had worked on the National Security Council. I tried to explain. The office is new, you're right. It's post-Cold War security, not focused just on nation-state threats. The boundaries between domestic and foreign have blurred. Threats to the U.S. now are not Soviet ballistic missiles carrying bombs, they're terrorists carrying bombs. I did not succeed entirely in making the case. Over the next several months, they suggested, I should figure out how to move some of these issues out to some other organization. Rice decided that the position of National Coordinator for Counterterrorism would also be downgraded. No longer would the coordinator be a member of the Principals Committee. No longer would the Counterterrorism Security Group report to the principals, but instead to a committee of deputy secretaries. At the same time, Rice requested that I develop a reorganization plan to spin out some of the security functions to someplace outside the NSC staff. Within a week of the inauguration, I wrote to Rice and Hadley, asking urgently for a principals or cabinet-level meeting to review the imminent Al-Qaeda threat. Rice told me the Principals Committee, which had been the first venue for terrorism policy discussions in the Clinton administration, would not address the issue until it had been framed by the deputies. I assumed that meant an opportunity for the deputies to review the agenda. Instead, it meant months of delay. Finally, in April, the Deputies Committee met on terrorism for the first time. The first meeting, in the small, wood-paneled Situation Room conference room, did not go well. Rice's deputy, Steve Hadley, began the meeting by asking me to brief the group. I turned immediately to the pending decisions needed to deal with Al-Qaeda. Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld's deputy at defense, fidgeted and scowled. Hadley asked him if he was all right.
Well, I just don't understand why we are beginning by talking about this one man, Bin Laden,
Wolfowitz responded. I answered as clearly and forcefully as I could.
We're talking about a network of terrorist organizations called Al-Qaeda that happens to be led by Bin Laden. And we're talking about that network because it, and it alone, poses an immediate and serious threat to the United States.
Well, there are others that do as well, at least as much. Iraqi terrorism, for example,
Wolfowitz replied, looking not at me, but at Hadley. I answered, I am unaware of any Iraqi-sponsored terrorism directed at the United States, Paul, since 1993, and I think FBI and CIA concur in that judgment. Right, John? I pointed at CIA Deputy Director John McLaughlin, who was obviously not eager to get in the middle of a debate between the White House and the Pentagon, but nonetheless replied, Yes, that is right, Dick. We have no evidence of any active Iraqi terrorism against the United States. Finally, Wolfowitz turned to me.
You give Bin Laden too much credit. He could not do all these things, like the 1993 attack on New York, not without a state sponsor. Just because FBI and CIA have failed to find the linkages does not mean they don't exist.
I could hardly believe it, but Wolfowitz was actually spouting the totally discredited Lori Milroy theory that Iraq was behind the 1993 truck bomb at the World Trade Center, a theory that had been investigated for years and found to be totally untrue. It was getting a little too heated for the kind of meeting Steve Hadley liked to chair, but I thought it was important to get the extent of the disagreement out on the table. So I said, Al-Qaeda plans major attacks of terrorism against the United States. It plans to overthrow Islamic governments and set up a radical multinational caliphate, and then go to war with non-Muslim states. Then I said something I regretted as soon as I had said it. They have published all of this, and sometimes, as with Hitler and Mein Kampf,
You have to believe that these people will actually do what they say they will do.
Immediately, Wolfowitz seized on the Hitler reference.
I resent any comparison between the Holocaust and this little terrorist in Afghanistan.
I wasn't comparing the Holocaust to anything. I spoke slowly.
I was saying that, like Hitler, Bin Laden told us in advance what he plans to do, and we would make a big mistake to ignore it.
To my surprise, Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage came to my rescue.
We agree with Dick. We see al-Qaeda as a major terrorist threat, and countering it as an urgent priority.
The briefings of Colin Powell had worked. Hadley suggested a compromise. We would begin by focusing on al-Qaeda, and then later look at other terrorism, including any Iraqi terrorism. I wasn't the only one asserting an al-Qaeda threat whom Wolfowitz belittled. Our ambassador to Indonesia, Robert Gelbard, was putting pressure on the Jakarta government to do something about al-Qaeda and its offshoot, Jemaah Islamiyah. Gelbard saw what was taking place in Indonesia. Al-Qaeda was targeting the largest Islamic nation in the world as its next battlefield. Arriving in the Pentagon early in 2001, Paul Wolfowitz began calling old acquaintances in Indonesia, where he had earlier been ambassador. What he heard from them was that Gelbard was making things uncomfortable, making too much noise about al-Qaeda, being paranoid. Wolfowitz reportedly urged Gelbard's removal. Bob Gelbard came home and retired from the Foreign Service. In October 2002, al-Qaeda's local front attacked nightclubs in Bali, killing 202, mainly Australians. 10 months later, they attacked the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta, killing 13. The investigations that followed revealed an extensive network of al-Qaeda operatives in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Malaysia, led by those whom Gelbard had suspected and had demanded be stopped. The delay in the Deputies Committee continued in the spring of 2001, in part because of Hadley's methodical, lawyerly style. It was his idea to slowly build a consensus that action was required. The truth was also that the Principals Committee was meeting with a full agenda and a backlog of Bush priority issues: the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the Kyoto Environment Agreement, and Iraq. There was no time for terrorism. Winter had turned to spring. One day, I saw an editorial cartoon of Uncle Sam sitting on a throne reading the ABM Treaty, while a fuse ran down on a bomb beneath his seat, and a terrorist ran away behind him. The cartoon hit me hard. My frustration was boiling over. I asked to be reassigned. I had completed the review of the organizational options for Homeland Defense and Critical Infrastructure Protection that Rice had asked me to conduct. There was agreement to create a separate, senior White House position for Critical Infrastructure Protection and Cybersecurity. I requested that I be given that assignment, to the apparent surprise of Condi Rice and Steve Hadley. Perhaps, I suggested, I've become too close to the terrorism issue. I've worked it for 10 years, and to me, it seems like a very important issue. But maybe I'm becoming like Captain Ahab, with Bin Laden as the white whale. Maybe you need someone less obsessive about it. We agreed that I would start the new job at the beginning of the new fiscal year, October 1st. In the remaining 4 months, however, I was intent on pushing hard to get an administration policy in place to go after al-Qaeda. George Tenet had also been asked to stay on from Clinton to Bush. He and I regularly commiserated that al-Qaeda was not being addressed more seriously. We agreed that Tenet would ensure that the president's daily briefings would continue to be replete with threat information on al-Qaeda. President Bush, reading the intelligence every day and noticing that there was a lot about al-Qaeda, asked Condi Rice why it was that we couldn't stop swatting flies and eliminate al-Qaeda.
Rice told me about the conversation and asked how the plan to get Al-Qaeda was coming in the deputies' committee.
It can be presented to the principals in 2 days, whenever we can get a meeting, I pressed.
Rice promised to get to it soon. Time passed. Around this time, George Tenet's calls to me about threatening intelligence reports became more frequent, and the information was good. There were a growing number of reports that Al-Qaeda's operational pace was picking up. Cells were discovered and rounded up by security services in Italy, France, and Germany. There were reliable reports of a threat to the U.S. Navy in Bahrain, causing me to call the Bahraini Crown Prince on a yacht in the Mediterranean to ask for increased security for our naval base and access to recently arrested Al-Qaeda prisoners. The Italians had credible reports that there would be an attempt to attack the G7 summit in Genoa, causing the counterterrorism security group to review plans for that meeting with the Secret Service and the Department of Defense. By late June, Tenet and I were convinced that a major series of attacks was about to come.
It's my sixth sense, but I can feel it coming.
This is going to be a big one, Tenet told me. During the spring, as initial policy debates in the administration began, I emailed Condi Rice and National Security Council staff colleagues that Al-Qaeda was trying to kill Americans, to have hundreds of dead in the streets of America. During the first week in July, I convened the counterterrorism security group and asked each agency to consider itself on full alert. I asked the agencies to cancel summer vacations and official travel for the counterterrorism response staffs. Each agency should report anything unusual, even if a sparrow should fall from a tree. I asked the FBI to send another warning to the 18,000 police departments, State to alert the embassies, and the Defense Department to go to threat condition Delta. The Navy moved ships out of Bahrain. The next day, I asked the senior security officials at FAA, Immigration, Secret Service, Coast Guard, Customs, and the Federal Protective Service to meet at the White House. I asked the FAA to send another security warning to the airlines and airports and requested special scrutiny at the ports of entry. We considered a broad public warning, but we had no proof or specificity. What would it say? A terrorist group you have never heard of may be planning to do something, somewhere. The FBI joined us, as well as a senior CIA counterterrorism expert, who explained that the CIA believed Al-Qaeda was preparing something. When he was done, I added what I had already told the counterterrorism security group agencies. You've just heard that CIA thinks Al-Qaeda is planning a major attack on us. So do I. You heard CIA say it would probably be in Israel or Saudi Arabia. Maybe. But maybe it'll be here. Just because there's no evidence that says it'll be here does not mean it will be overseas. They may try to hit us at home. You have to assume that is what they're going to try to do. Cancel summer vacations. Schedule overtime. Have your terrorist reaction teams on alert to move fast. Tell me, tell each other, about anything unusual. Somewhere in the CIA, there was information that two known Al-Qaeda terrorists had come into the United States. Somewhere in the FBI, there was information that strange things had been going on at flight schools in the United States. None of that information got to me or to the White House. It apparently did not even make it up the FBI chain to Dale Watson, the executive assistant director in charge of counterterrorism. On September 4, 2001, the principals' committee meeting on Al-Qaeda that I had called for urgently on January 25th finally met. In preparation for that meeting, I urged Condi Rice to see the issue cleanly. The administration could decide that Al-Qaeda was just a nuisance, a cost of doing business for a superpower, as Reagan and the first President Bush had apparently decided about Hezbollah and Libya when those groups had killed hundreds of Americans, and act accordingly, as it had been doing. Or it could decide that the Al-Qaeda terrorist group and its affiliates posed an existential threat to the American way of life, in which case
we should do everything that might be required to eliminate the threat. There was no in-between.
I concluded by noting that before choosing from these alternatives, it would be well for Rice to put herself in her own shoes when, in the very near future, Al-Qaeda had killed hundreds of Americans. What will you wish then that you had already done? The principals' meeting, when it finally took place, was largely a non-event. Tennant and I spoke passionately about the urgency and seriousness of the Al-Qaeda threat. No one disagreed. Powell laid out an aggressive strategy for putting pressure on Pakistan to side with us against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Money might be needed, he noted, but there was no plan to find the funds. Rumsfeld, who looked distracted throughout the session, took the Wolfowitz line that there were other terrorist concerns like Iraq, and whatever we did on this Al-Qaeda business, we had to deal with the other sources of terrorism. Tennant agreed to a series of things that the CIA would do to be more aggressive, but the details would be worked offline. I doubted that process would be fruitful anytime soon. The only heated disagreement came over whether to fly the armed Predator over Afghanistan to attack Al-Qaeda. Neither the CIA nor the Defense Department would agree to run that program. Rice ended the discussion without a solution. She asked that I finalize the broad policy document, a national security presidential directive on Al-Qaeda, and send it to her for presidential signature. Could we have stopped the September 11th attack? It would be facile to say yes. What is clear is that there were failures in the organizations that we trusted to protect us. Failures to get information to the right place at the right time. Earlier failures to act boldly to reduce or eliminate the threat. It must be said, in truth, that if we had stopped those 19 deluded fools who acted on September 11th, as we should have done, there would have been more later. At some point, there would probably still have been a horrific attack that would have required the United States to respond massively and systematically to eliminate Al-Qaeda and its network. Al-Qaeda had emerged from the soil after the Cold War like some long-dormant plague. It was on a path of its own, and it would not be swayed. And America, alas, seems only to respond well to disasters, to be undistracted by warnings. After September 11th, I thought that the arguments would be over. The right war was to fight for the elimination of Al-Qaeda, to stabilize nations threatened by radical Islamic terrorists, to offer a clear alternative to counter the radical theology and ideology of the terrorists, and to reduce our vulnerabilities at home. It was an obvious agenda. Roger Cressy, my deputy at the National Security Council staff, came to me in early October, after the time I had intended to switch from the terrorism job to the critical infrastructure protection and cybersecurity position. The switch had been delayed by September 11th.
You're not going to move now, are you? Finally, they're paying attention to you, so you want to hang around and get your white whale, huh?
I was exhausted from the 10 years in the White House, from the marathon since the attacks, from the sleepless nights going over what I might have done to prevent the attacks. I looked at Cressy. Well, Raj, as I said before, counterterrorism from now on will be a self-looking ice cream cone. It won't need anybody like me running it. Everybody will know what to do now. There won't be disagreements over policy or any need for a ramrod to get things done. It's obvious stuff now. We gave them the game plan. Hell, we gave it to them in January.
Cressy was beginning to smile back at me. He saw where I was going. I said, cybersecurity is a virgin issue where we can make a real impact. A month later, after a 6-hour trip from Washington, we walked into a bar in Silicon Valley. I had just become the special advisor to the president for cyberspace security and was going to spend 2 weeks getting to know the leaders of the high-tech industry in California. In Palo Alto, as in most of America, life was going on. The people trusted, as I did, that the mechanisms of government now awakened would deal with the terrorist threat completely
and systematically. We were wrong. Replacing me as the senior National Security Council counterterrorism official was Wayne Downing, the retired four-star Army general who had led Special Operations Command. Wayne was a no-nonsense kind of general, the perfect man for the job of coordinating the post-September 11th response. Within months of replacing me, Wayne Downing quit the White House in frustration at the administration's continued bureaucratic response to the threat. Wayne was replaced by two people, John Gordon and Randy Beers. As with Downing, I had known Beers and Gordon for a long time. Beers had enormous experience working on intelligence policy and operations, terrorism, foreign military operations, and law enforcement. He, too, was the perfect man for the job. Beers called from the White House months later and asked if he could stop by my house for a drink and some advice. I sat on the stoop of my old Sears catalog house and thought back to the night 12 years earlier when I'd been sitting there drinking Lagavulin and cursing the CIA for saying that Iraq would not invade Kuwait. Older now and off scotch, I opened a bottle of Pinot Noir. When Beers sat down next to me, his first words were, "I think I have to quit." I thought I knew why, but I asked. His answer flowed like a river at flood. "They still don't get it. Instead of going all out against Al-Qaeda and eliminating our vulnerabilities at home, they want to fucking invade Iraq again. We have a token U.S. military force in Afghanistan. The Taliban are regrouping. We haven't caught bin Laden, or his deputy, or the head of the Taliban, and they aren't going to send any more troops to Afghanistan to catch them, or to help the government in Kabul secure the country. No, they're holding back, waiting to invade Iraq. Do you know how much it will strengthen Al-Qaeda and groups like it if we occupy Iraq? There's no threat to us now from Iraq, but 70% of the American people think Iraq attacked the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. You want to know why? Because that's what the administration wants them to think." I could see there was some considerable built-up anxiety with the Bush administration. I got another bottle of Pinot Noir. Randy continued, "Worse yet, they're using the war on terror politically. You know that document from Karl Rove's office that someone found in the park? Remember how it said the Republicans should run for election on the war issue? Well, they did. They're doing Wag the Dog. They ran against Max Cleland, saying he wasn't patriotic because he didn't agree 100% with how Bush wanted to do Homeland Security. Max Cleland, who lost three of his four limbs for this country in Vietnam." Beers had lost hearing in one ear in Vietnam, where he had served two tours as a Marine. "I can't work for these people. I'm sorry. I just can't." Beers resigned, and the churn of senior counterterrorism officials continued. John Gordon was transferred shortly thereafter to the position vacated by Tom Ridge as Homeland Security Advisor. Looking at this revolving door in the counterterrorism job after my departure, and thinking back to the 10 months that I had served President Bush as his National Coordinator for Counterterrorism and Infrastructure Protection, I am still amazed that I had never been given the chance to talk to him about terrorism until September 11th. In fact, during that time, I had only three meetings where I developed the agenda and briefed him on issues, but each time on subjects other than terrorism. From the interactions I did have with Bush, it was clear that the critique of him as a dumb, lazy, rich kid were somewhat off the mark. When he focused, he asked the kind of questions that revealed a results-oriented mind, but he looked for the simple solution, the bumper sticker description of the problem. Once he had that, he could put energy behind a drive to achieve his goal. The problem was that many of the important issues, like terrorism, like Iraq, were laced with important subtlety and nuance. These issues needed analysis, and Bush and his inner circle had no real interest in complicated analyses. On the issues that they cared about, they already knew the answers. It was received wisdom. Bush was informed by talking with a small set of senior advisors. Early on, we were told, "The president is not a big reader and goes to bed by 10.
Clinton, by contrast, would be plowing through an inbox filled with staff memos while watching cable television news well after midnight. There were clearly innumerable differences between Clinton and Bush, most of them obvious. But the most telling for me was how the two sought and processed information. Bush wanted to get to the bottom line and move on. Clinton sought to hold every issue before him like a Rubik's Cube, examining it from every angle to the point of total distraction for his staff. Many times since September 11th, I have wondered what difference it made that George Bush was president when we were attacked. What if it had happened when Clinton was still in office? Or what if the Florida voting procedures had been otherwise? Although Bush had heard about al-Qaeda in intelligence reports before the attack, he had spent little time learning about the sources and nature of the movement. His immediate instinct after the attacks was, naturally, to hit back. His framework, however, was summed up by his famous line, "You're either with us or against us," and his early focus on dealing with Iraq as a way of demonstrating American power. I doubt that anyone ever had the chance to make the case to him that attacking Iraq would actually make America less secure and would strengthen the broader radical Islamic terrorist movement. Any leader whom one can imagine as president on September 11th would have declared a war on terrorism and would have ended the Afghan sanctuary by invading. Almost any president would have stepped up domestic security and preparedness measures. In the end, what was unique about George Bush's reaction to terrorism was his selection as an object lesson for potential state sponsors of terrorism, not a country that had been engaging in anti-U.S. terrorism, but one that had not been, Iraq. It's hard to imagine another president making that choice. Others, Clinton, the first Bush, Carter, Ford, might have tried to understand the phenomenon of terrorism. What led 15 Saudis and others to commit suicide to kill Americans? Others might have tried to build a world consensus to address the root causes while using the moment to force what had been lethargic or doubting governments to arrest known terrorists and close front organizations. One can imagine Clinton trying one more time to force an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, going to Saudi Arabia and addressing the Muslim people in a moving appeal for religious tolerance, pushing hard for a security arrangement between India and Pakistan to create a nuclear-free zone, and stabilizing Pakistan. Such efforts may or may not have succeeded, but one thing we know they would not have done is inflame Islamic opinion and further radicalize Muslim youth into heightened hatred of America, as we did by invading Iraq. It was plainly obvious when four aircraft were hijacked that airline security had to be improved, but Bush resisted calls for making the airport's security screeners federal employees. Then, when he lost that battle to Congress, he placed an old family friend, John McCaw, as head of the new agency to run the security screeners. Within months, McGaw had to be replaced under congressional criticism. It was to become a pattern. Bush and his prep school roommate, Clay Johnson, the White House personnel director, looked first to family loyalists and political cronies to staff key positions. As one Republican columnist told me, "These guys are more inbred, secretive, and vindictive than the mafia." It was also plainly obvious after September 11th that al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Taliban-run Afghanistan had to be occupied by U.S. forces, and the al-Qaeda leaders killed. Unfortunately, Bush's efforts were slow and small. He began by again offering the Taliban a chance to avoid U.S. occupation of their country, and when that failed, he initially sent in only a handful of special forces. When the Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders escaped, he dispatched additional forces, but less than one full division equivalent. Fewer U.S. troops for all of Afghanistan than the number of New York police in Manhattan. One would have thought that it was equally obvious after September 11th that high on the priority list would have been improving U.S. relations with the Islamic world in order to dry up support for the deviant variant of Islam that is al-Qaeda. To defeat that enemy and prevent it from achieving its objectives, we needed to do more than just arrest and kill people. We and our values needed to be more appealing to Muslims than al-Qaeda is. By all measures, however, Al-Qaeda and similar groups were increasing in support from Morocco to Indonesia. If that trend continues, the radical imams and their madras schools will produce more terrorists than we jail or shoot. Far from addressing the popular appeal of the enemy that attacked us, Bush handed that enemy precisely what it wanted and needed. Proof that America was at war with Islam, that we were the new crusaders come to occupy Muslim land. Nothing America could have done would have provided Al-Qaeda and its new generation of cloned groups a better recruitment device than our unprovoked invasion of an oil-rich Arab country. Nothing else could have so well negated all our other positive acts and so closed Muslim eyes and ears to our subsequent calls for reform in their region. It was as if Osama bin Laden, hidden in some high mountain redoubt, were engaging in long-range mind control of George Bush, chanting, "Invade Iraq. You must invade Iraq." Chapter 11. Right War, Wrong War. What would a successful and comprehensive counterterrorism effort have looked like after September 11th? It would have consisted of three key agenda items. Priority number one would have been eliminating vulnerabilities to terrorism at home and strengthening homeland security. In the days after September 11th, the White House realized that the president needed to make a more comprehensive statement to the American people about what had happened and what we were going to do about it. Something easily understandable had to be said about preventing attacks in the U.S. The president chose, in his speech before a joint session of Congress, to announce a person, the governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge. Bush had asked Ridge to come to the White House to run Homeland Security. A few days later, I drove to the governor's mansion in Harrisburg, along with General Wayne Downing. We found Ridge packing, since he had just resigned, to go to Washington. When we briefed him on Homeland Protection activities that had been underway for 5 years, he seemed somewhat relieved. "This is great. I thought I was going to have to start from scratch." But Tom Ridge had bought a pig in a poke when he agreed to come to Washington to help on Homeland Security. He assumed that he would have real authority as assistant to the president for Homeland Security. But he soon found that he could do nothing without first clearing it with White House Chief of Staff Andy Card. Although Ridge opposed the idea of creating a new department and loathed the idea of becoming its secretary, he was forced to do so by Bush and Card. Being governor of Pennsylvania was not like actually running a nationwide department with almost 200,000 employees doing sensitive and critical security functions. Ridge was, at root, a politician, not a manager or a security expert. I believed that adept White House coordination and leadership could get the many agencies all working on a consistent overall program. As a career civil servant with almost 30 years' experience in Washington headquarters, I believed that the alternative method, rewiring the organizational boxes, would make us less able to deal with the domestic security and preparedness issues for years to come. Ridge agreed and